Hi, I'm Allison Hess.
And I'm Stephanie Graham.
Welcome to the Thousand Islands Playhouse Podcast.
For the 2025 season, we have seven amazing productions taking place in our Springer and Fire Hall theaters.
Join us as we talk to the artists that will make this season shine and get a behind-the-scenes peek at what's happening this summer dockside.
Don't forget to tune in
to give your ears a front row seat.
See you at the theater.
Welcome back to the 2025 season of the Playhouse Podcast. We're recording today on the ancestral lands of the Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabeg peoples, and we're recording on-site at our production facility. I'm Stephanie Graham, Artistic Associate here at the Playhouse.
And I'm Allison Hess, Education and Engagement Manager. Welcome to our last episode and our last production of the 2025 season, The Piano Teacher. When a renowned classical pianist experiences a devastating family tragedy, she finds herself unable to play music or even touch a piano. Navigating her way through the traumatic loss of the life she knew, she meets an unconventional piano teacher who reacquaints her with the instrument and gives her new hope for the future. The Piano Teacher is a beautiful story of loss, love, friendship, and the healing power of music.
What a show to wrap up the Fire Hall season. And for our last guests of the podcast season, we are excited to speak to two of the artists working on The Piano Teacher, director Evelyn Perry and actor Karen Randoja.
Hello, welcome.
Welcome.
Hello, happy to be here.
Thanks for coming.
Hello.
Thanks for chatting with us.
Thank you for both joining us. Evelyn, this is your debut at the Thousand Islands Playhouse. You are award-winning Canadian performance maker and theatrical innovator who has worked as a creator, performer, musician, and director. You were the artistic director of Buddies in Bad Times Theatre from 2015 to 2020, and you are a founding member of the acclaimed feminist collective, Independent Aunties, with whom you've co-authored and performed six plays, including Gertrude and Alice, Breakfast, and the award-winning festival favorite, Clean Irene and Dirty Maxine. Welcome.
Thank you.
Just a few little bits of all the amazing things you've done. And Karen, listeners of our podcast might have seen you in Thousand Island Playhouse production of Amelia, The Girl Who Wanted to Fly, back in 2012. You were also a founding member of the Independent Aunties, along with Evelyn and Anna Chatterton, as well as a founding member of Primus Theatre. You have spent over 30 years specializing in acting in, creating, and directing original devised performances. So cool.
Thank you.
I know we'll kind of get into it, but what is devised theater in a nutshell?
Good question. Devised theater for me is theater that has never been made before. And it's always in process, so you're creating it, you're devising it.
And not usually script-based to begin, right? Like, I think that's one of the things I would differentiate between what people assume about most plays is that a script comes first. And certainly in the work that we have devised together, usually a script doesn't come first. The script grows out of the work.
Yeah, there's a lot of different physical explorations, character explorations, discussions. It can be quite far from where you end up, but it's so much fun to explore and keep looking for the right moments.
I love it because it's so much more, even from the beginning, so collaborative compared to the kind of vision we have of like a playwright like locking themselves away in a cabin and like scribbling until their masterpiece is created, which I know a lot of theater isn't that anyways, because you know you have a piece of that you've written and you work on it, but the idea of kind of starting with that collaboration is a really cool thing. Which, speaking of, you two have collaborated for more than 15 years, more than 20.
Yeah, we have been. I mean, it's interesting. We haven't actually done a new project in a little while. The last project that we worked on was Gertrude and Alice that had two different productions in 2016 and 18, I think. Is that right? But before that, yeah, our collaboration goes back to the early aughts.
Oh, wow,
so
amazing.
It's been a minute.
Oh, that's so amazing. And how did you two connect and start working together? Like, did you just, you know, meet each other and be like, oh my gosh, our brains are the same. We need to do this all the time? Or?
Well, Anna Chatterton, who's our other collaborator, there's three of us in the Aunties, and Anna and I are both, Anna's more primarily a writer, but when we began, when we were closer to our being new graduates from a theater school and starting our careers, we were both creator performers. Mm-hmm. And we were looking for a director for a script that we had written. It was an unconventional script. It was all written in rhyme, and it kind of had like a playful quality to it. It was a sort of political, social commentary. It was funny, and we wanted a director, and we were really interested in physical theater. And we'd seen some of Karen's work, because Karen was kind of newer back from Primus to Toronto at that time. I mean...
Yeah, I had just arrived. I decided to leave the company Primus after 7 years, and I moved back to Toronto. Mm-hmm.
So we had graduated theater school and moved back from Montreal, and Karen was... So we were all in Toronto in a little, I guess, a circle of people where we got introduced through colleagues, but we'd seen some of Karen's work and thought, like, it would be very exciting to work with her. And another colleague, Soraya Pierby, was the one who kind of match-made us and said, Karen would be great. And we worked together on Queen Irene, which was a bit of... I mean, in a sense, it was kind of like... We felt like we were auditioning for Karen, because... Karen seemed like a lot more experience and a sort of worldliness in her practice that, you know, we felt very much like emerging artists, and we were very excited to work with her. And then we really found a match with each other through that project.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if I wanted to work with them. But, and then we started rehearsing very quickly. We were on the floor laughing. We were so ridiculous. They would do anything I asked, and we just got more and more strange and outlandish. And it just felt like we all were connecting with one brain, really. So it was kind of a beautiful find to find each other.
We did, in that case, like, back to this question of devising, we had made a script, but it really felt like when Karen came into the collaboration, so Anna and I had collaborated to write the script, and then Karen's direction became almost like a physical score, like a third writer in a way. It lifted off the page in a way that you couldn't have written in stage directions. It wouldn't have made any sense. It was a whole other flavor that really met ours and took it further and weirder and wilder. And we, yeah, like Karen said, it was a sense of, you know, when you make something that really feels bigger than the sum of its parts, it was like, whoa, these three people come together and something new has emerged for all of us.
That's so very special. It doesn't happen very often when those all three people are firing at the same time. And
it's funny, we were getting our photos taken for this production that was going to be in some festivals. And I heard this, the photographer's assistant or somebody kind of lean in and go, get them all, get their energy together. And you can really sense that we come alive together. The energy we already have, times that by three, it can be a bit much, but it's awesome.
So when did that solidify into the independent Auntie?
I think after, well, Queen Irene. We did it on a festival, and Summerworks Festival, and then it won the Summerworks Prize, and... Then the prize that you won was admission to next year's festival. So then we were like,
we better
create
something
else. We have to make
a
new show. So I guess in a sense, and then it was like, do we want to do this together? Yes, we do. And then we made something from scratch together that wasn't a script first, that was really a devised process where we began with some images and some ideas about characters and themes that we wanted to pursue and made a show. And that was the beginning of many more makings. And actually, that show was called Frances, Matilda, and Tea. And we wrote it when we were still in our 20s. When we sort of wrote it, it tells a story of two sisters who won't leave the house and who are kind of neurotic and have a strange, entwined relationship with each other and sort of psychodramatic relationship. And we had the thought when we were making it that this would be, in fact, they could be in their 50s or their 60s, not their 20s, and it would be even weirder and more psychotic. And we were like, when we're 50, we have to do this again. So maybe one day soon.
It's time for a revival.
It might be time for a revival of Frances, Matilda, and Tea.
So you both were recently involved in the 52 Live, Stories of Women Who Transformed Toronto, with the Museum of Toronto in association with Luminato Festival. So that was earlier this year. Even reading about it is such an interesting program and interesting theatrical experience. So Evelyn, you were the director and co-creator, and Karen, you were one of the performers. Can you tell us a bit about that? Because, you know, I think especially our listening audience, they love theater. And I love in the last like decade or so, the different ways that we're, you know, changing how theater is produced and performed and where it's performed and how to experience it. And it seemed like such a really cool project.
Yeah, the 52 was 52 monologues that the Museum of Toronto commissioned from 24 Toronto-based playwrights about women who had made an impact in Toronto. It's a real range and diversity of people that are highlighted in this that range from historical characters who are long dead to those who are still alive. And we presented the monologues, all 52 of them, inside the Toronto Archive building, which is, it's a very cool building that stores the archives of the city. Part of the building is open to the public. It's a free city resource. You could go there to research your house, for instance, and like find out the history of who's owned it before and when it was built and things like that, which is the reason most people know about the Toronto Archives. But also there's this incredible, the stacks, the storage room is this wild three-story high building full of cardboard boxes in rather beautifully designed shelves. So it's just a very dramatic space. And we were looking for a space. The museum had hired me to direct these 52 monologues. They wanted a theatrical rendition of the monologues. And I was like, the last thing we want to do is put that on a stage in a theater. 52 monologues sounds like something nobody wants to see. But like, let's find a house, let's find an interesting place that they could live and do something that involves an audience moving around and getting to experience a space and bring these characters to life. And it felt like a library was the perfect space in the sense of archiving or bringing to life women's stories who have rarely been told in the archive. So it was a walking tour for the audience. We did 4 nights of performance, 2 shows a night, 8 characters, give or take, each performance. So we worked through all 52. So there was no repeat performances.
Oh,
and
cool.
Karen was part of almost all of them because she played six characters. So
tell us about them, Karen. Who did you play?
Oh, now you ask me the names and I'm in rehearsal right now, so I can't remember anything, but
for your lines.
Except for my lines, Evelyn, director. I played a woman in the 1930s who was a mathematician from Germany. I played a Portuguese writer who had moved to Toronto, and I wrote about her experience being an immigrant in Toronto. I played Lillian H. Smith, who was the founder of the children's libraries, and I played her as if she was, well, no, it was written as if she was dead and had come back to life to talk to all these people. And I played a volunteer at the Art Gallery of Toronto, which is now the Art Gallery of Ontario, and her experience building up the art in Toronto. I played a mayor of Mississauga.
Before it was Mississauga.
Before it was Mississauga. And then I played a woman who is still alive and actually came to see the performance, which was very weird.
Oh, wow.
Kathy Crowe, yeah.
Kathy Crowe, who is a street nurse for the unsheltered.
What a breadth of characters.
Yeah, and the weird thing is, in order for everyone to see it, you had to do it 6 times in a row. So you get a 5-minute break and then do it again. 5-minute break, do it again. And every night for those 4 nights, I thought, oh, I got to do it a couple more times. And then they'd be like, no, it's over. You've done 6. I'm like, I've done 6? I've done 6? I thought I did 4. But it was actually really, it was such a special, cool project to be part of. And I thank Evelyn for letting me be part of it.
And what was that like? Every audience is a little bit different. Every group is a little different.
I mean, one of the main things was it was very intimate, mm-hmm. because you'd be in small spaces, like a little, you know, everyone around a table. So actually, I found the most interesting thing is people really wanted to engage, but they were kind of nervous about the intensity. So I would look at them and they would want to look, but they'd also look away. If there was teenagers there, they would not look at me at all. They just like look down on the floor. I'm not looking at that lady. It was a really good thing about being confident and warm and generous without expecting anything back, because it's hard to be so close to a performer who's looking right at you.
And there's no dark theater for them to hide in.
And there's no dark theater for them.
But it's also challenging for the actor too, or for some actors, I think, to be that exposed too, that you don't have, you know, the lights between you and the audience. You're just in a room sharing a table with them. There was one of the things that I said to all the actors was like, it's really about hosting the audience. Like every character, your job is like to talk to them like you're there and they're there. And there's no convention of the usual theatrical divisions. And I felt like you did that so beautifully, Karen.
I love that. And I love like taking theater out of the theater space and challenging both, I guess, like actors and audience to reinvent what that looks like.
Yeah.
Another thing that was neat about it was that it was like in that case, it was also like the building itself was a sort of a character in the experience for audiences. And we treated it as such, like that was kind of the concept, was that people would have this encounter not only with these women's stories, but also with the building.
And without fail, when you got to the stacks, including when we were rehearsing, the first time you walk in, everyone goes, oh my God. And then they start clapping.
Just because the room itself is so gigantic, wild.
I think that's an interesting thing about sites of civic work, is that it is a conversation, not just the audience and the performers, but the space. Mm.
Totally.
I think we should turn now to the play that's happening here at the Playhouse.
I mean, I guess we could talk about all of the... I would just love to hear you tell stories, both of you, all night. But yes, I agree.
What drew you both to the piano teacher?
Well, Brett gave me the script and said, would I be interested in directing? And I was actually pulled into it really immediately. After one read was like, it's a yes. First, like I'm really interested in the story and moved by the story. And it lifted off the page in a way of reading that sometimes, you know, it's interesting. Reading plays isn't always the easiest way to encounter a play. And this one really just the themes, I think, around the way that Dorothy Dietrich, who's the playwright, has written about grief and about music, these two themes. I mean, there's many themes, and about teaching. I think those, like, hit me with so much truth. Just felt like there was a lot of resonance in it. I mean, I work often using music in some way integrated into performance, and every project's unique. This one is quite interesting because the playwright has basically like curated a score for the piece. And, you know, usually when directing something, your sound designer and the director will work together to figure out how sound and or music might be used, and it might be or maybe composed for the piece or pulled from existing music. But this is like so specific and written into the script in a way that's like must be followed. And that intrigued me too, of like, I liked that it was baked into the project, but allowed me to engage with a piece that would have music embedded in the way that the story was told.
Even when I was reading it for the first time too, I like being able to put those pieces on while I was reading it, like even just the reading experience really pulled
you did
in.
That?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah,
You're
I did that
awesome.
Too.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just to be like, okay, great. And like putting that in kind of as like a background score, even just to the reading, was a really interesting way of engaging with it and engaging with, you know, your character's monologues and how they connect it too. So yeah, I get that. So when you read it, did you, you know, imagine Karen in that role, or did that kind of come later? Because again, I know you with your history and you know each other so well. Was it sort of like...
I did think, I mean, I was in thinking about casting it, Karen came to my mind really like, oh, this would be amazing. So she was the first person that I cast, and it is the titular role, but
you
it felt like...
You are the piano teacher.
You are the piano teacher.
I am the piano teacher.
But it felt like the piano teacher, there were some qualities that really spoke to me about Karen inside of her, that she's a very warm character who makes people feel at home. And she's also kind of unconventional in her approach to teaching and...
And super childish. Playful. Let's say playful.
Yes, very playful. I wouldn't at all say childish. Like,
super playful.
Very, very playful. I mean, the whole play, part of what's beautiful too about the play is like there's this light touch to it, that it's about grief and yet it's about all these heavy themes and yet it has a playfulness to it. So, I mean, definitely Karen's playful energy. And I guess having experienced, you know, because we work together mostly as Karen directing me, it's new for the roles to be reversed in this sense.
How's that going on day three so far?
Well, I guess the first thing you directed was 52. It's great. I love being told what to do and just listening to you, seeing the whole big vision and being a part of it. But it's great.
I mean, there was one of the Aunties shows that Brendan Healy directed a number of years ago. It was the first show of ours that Karen didn't direct. No, there was another one?
Robber's Daughter.
Oh, Robber's Daughter's first, right. Well, anyway, it was maybe a bigger production. And so Brendan was directing and Anna and I were acting in it, but Karen was really the lead role in it. And we got to see, and so we'd never really seen her like be the lead, and it was amazing. It was an amazing performance. And I'm always just like, why is Karen not on every stage in our country? I don't understand. She's a hidden talent. In a lot of people know her in Toronto for directing, but not many people know her work on stage because you've been busy as a director and divisor. So it just seemed like a fun opportunity. I was like, this character's perfect, and put Karen on stage and I get to direct her. And
what about you, Karen?
Had you read it before? Had you seen the play?
No.
And so when Evelyn approached you, was that sort of your first experience?
Yes,
with the play?
I was on the GO train with my sister and the script arrived and I read it and I was like, oh, I'm going to do this. Any opportunity, I'm at an age and a place where unless it's something I really don't like, I will say yes, because I just want to do art. And so this is another chance to do it.
Yeah, and we're really grateful that the two of you came and are able to come and work with us and in Gann.
And which is a great place.
Yeah.
Gann and Akwe is beautiful.
So, you know, as we mentioned, grief is such a complex and very internal experience and emotion. How do you approach it and try to bring it out without, I don't know, going to melodrama or one of the quote unquote easier emotions like anger or right? Like, how do you navigate that while still being really true to the subject matter?
I think one of the threads in the arc of the story in this case is Aaron, the classical pianist who's suffered a traumatic loss, is kind of in a stage of grief that's like about being frozen. In a sense. So her grief means that she can't play the piano. And so part of the story is kind of about like unthawing that, like allowing her like to figure out how to unlock the grief. I don't know, when we say the word grief, one of the first places my brain goes is like, oh, the five or six stages of grief where there's like depression, denial, anger, acceptance. The newest stage that I think has been added to Kubler-Ross's like framework for that is meaning making, which I think is so lovely because in a way, and we haven't even talked about this in rehearsal yet, but I think like Elaine, the piano teacher's role in this is about meaning making. So anyway, it doesn't feel like it's one note. Like it's not about something heavy in a certain, it's not about crying all the way through the show, not at all. In fact, it's like she can't even access her feelings because music is such a powerful, emotive,
visceral
space. Like she can't touch it because she can't access her feelings.
And I think for the piano teacher, she also has a reason why she can't really play music. Mm-hmm. I won't say it now. Come see the show. Like at one point she says, grief is humbling. It is all consuming. It takes everything. And that's very true. And we've all gone through grief probably at this point in our lives. And it's so particular. Mm-hmm. It's so not one thing. Mm-hmm. And you really can't, you think you have control. Like I remember when my father died, I would be so shocked because I wasn't making this happen, but I'd be really okay and kind of watching something and laughing. And the next minute I'd be crying and just like devastated. And then I would come out and I'd be okay. And I'd be like, oh, I think this is what they call grief. It's it's up and down. It's up and down. It's just coming out of me.
Just picking up on that, Karen, I think you said it's sort of all consuming, which I think is an interesting parallel for a classical pianist to become a classical pianist.
Yeah.
That is also a completely consuming profession.
As you said, it's so much of an identity. To call yourself an artist sometimes feels like job and identity and everything is all wrapped up in one. But
I know a lot of people went through a lot in COVID and it's so weird. We almost don't talk about it anymore. I really appreciated because everything I was doing, I could not do. Singing, acting, directing, teaching, anything, babysitting because I take care of a lot of kids. And I realized I don't know who I am. All of my identity has been in my activities and people coming back to tell me who I am. And then I play the role of who I am, especially as a teacher or a director. And so I think this play also says like you go through it because you'll be transformed. You change. And it's kind of healthy not to be one identity and to go a little deeper and find out maybe more about yourself. And I feel like this play very much does that.
It's neat that you bring up COVID too, because as I thought more about after I read the play for the first time and was considering directing it, there's always a question with any work that I'm doing about why this right now?
Why here? Why now?
Yeah. And it felt immediately like there was a feeling for me of like, oh, this is a good play for right now. We need to process a lot of grief. There's such a specter that still hovers, and we see that in so many ways playing out, including just in the turmoil in the world right now. Mm. So it seemed like a nice time to be able to sit in the theater with a story that's a quiet, kind of contained story about grief. It's not about COVID, but yet it's a cathartic kind of story. It's like to witness somebody's journey of processing something traumatic and coming out the other side and being able to turn a corner.
So, you know, with the piano teacher, it's a three-person show. We're on day three, I believe.
we're like deep into the wormhole. Yeah, it feels like, right? We've been here for a month already.
Yeah. How has the experience been? I mean, you have a fantastic cast. How are you guys gelling? Like, how has the experience been over the last first couple days?
Well, as far as being in a cast again and with other actors, I'm blown away by both of them. I just feel like this is a very strong cast. And I'm not faking this, Gananoque, it just seems like this theater has a really good vibe of good people mm-hmm. who enjoy working together. Mm-hmm. And we're rehearsing right near the where everything is getting built. And always I'm like, okay, Karen, you might be tired. You might be having trouble remembering your lines. But every time I look down that hallway, I'm like, they work so hard. They work so hard. They're building everything from scratch. And even just that energy of like just being down the hall from the costumes, the sets, the everything, props, is quite inspiring.
Yeah, it's nice to have all of that in one space.
Yeah.
Because I think so often we feel separate in a company as a cast. Mm-hmm.
And we separate ourselves into little pockets.
Sometimes. And, you know, it's a good reminder when we come to tech, it's sort of like that's when we come together. But here in the rehearsal process at the production facility, we're all together, which is nice.
Have there been any specific spots like restaurants or shops that you've, you know, explored?
I can definitely shout out some things because mm-hmm. this is my... I live in Lansdowne now, or near Lansdowne.
Do you?
So I'm a fan of pistachio here in town. I like
gelato.
Their coffee, and their gelato is really good. And their grilled cheese sandwiches are also really good. And I was a big fan of the Painted Turtle, so I was sad when it went. But also, MJ's makes great coffee. I was actually helping out at the Purple House a little bit this summer, and I was big. Now it's closed for the season, but it's a great establishment with the best patio ever.
Mm-hmm. Great patio and great pizza.
Yeah. I have one more Gann shout out, actually.
Sure.
That's my other, not really new favorite place, but I love, it's just outside of town, Bereka, the farm store. It's like closer to the 401, so it's off of King Street, turns into 2. You have to drive like past the entrance to the parkway. It's between the entrance to the parkway and the 401. Anyway, and you go
check
down.
It out.
It's really cool. They make all like tons of organic stuff. It's like a family run bakery.
Wonderful.
And I think they have chickens and goats. And anyway, it's a good place.
Oh,
Bereka
cool.
Farm.
Yeah, well, check that out. Awesome. Well, thank you both for coming and speaking with us. I'm excited. Always, I feel like I'm excited for every show all the time, but.
It's a great season.
Yeah, it is a great season, and it was really great to get a chance to talk to you two in such great detail and hear your stories, and I'm looking forward to the piano teacher, so thanks a lot for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks. Thank you, as always, to Mark Hunt for composing the music for the Playhouse podcast. For more ticket information, please visit us at thousandislandsplayhouse.com.
See you at the theater!